Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. President Barack Obama took office surrounded by crisis. A year and a half later, that's still where he finds himself. He's made big strides, taken big pushback, soldiered on, and now finds himself and the country in the middle of a devastating oil spill and still more global economic turmoil. Liberals say he hasn't done enough. Conservatives say he's gone too far. Everybody seems to want more passion on the Gulf oil crisis. But this is a president who focuses on what he can do. This hour on Point, the Obama presidency, a year and a half in. You can join the conversation. How are you sizing up this president in the thick of a first term, in the thick of an oil spill disaster? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me today in our studio is Jonathan Alter, columnist and senior editor for Newsweek, contributing correspondent for NBC News. His new book, big new book, is The Promise, President Obama Year One. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. It's just out. Jonathan Alter, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks very much, Tom.
And with us from San Diego, California, is Robert Kuttner, co-founder and co-editor of the American Prospect magazine. His new book is A Presidency in Peril, the inside story of Obama's promise, Wall Street's power, and the struggle to control our economic future. Excerpt of this one as well at our website, onpointradio.org. Bob Kuttner, welcome back. Great to have you.
Always a pleasure.
Nothing seemed to be going just right for the president this weekend. Here he is, rained out, thunderstormed out in Illinois, where he was to address a substantial crowd at the Abraham Lincoln National Cemetery down the road from Chicago. Then the lightning came and the thunder. The president asked the crowd to get out of the open.
We don't want to endanger anybody, particularly their children in the audience. So I'd ask everybody to very calmly move back to your cars. I'm going to move back to mine.
He moved back to his, though his convoy had a blowout on the way back to the airport, and he finally gave the speech to a little crowd in Washington. Not the best Memorial Day. Last week, taking lots of feet, let's just get a little flavor of this, and then we'll dive in. Everybody's heard it by now, but just one voice, but a loud Louisiana voice, James Carville, calling for the president to go after BP with a little more vigor.
BP is not the equal of the United States government. And this president needs to tell BP, I'm your daddy. I'm in charge. You're going to do what we say. You're a multinational company that is greedy, and you may be guilty of criminal activity.
I'm your daddy, James Carville wanted to hear. The president came to Louisiana on Friday. That wasn't exactly his message. Here's what President Obama did say as he stood on the Gulf Coast.
I'm here to tell you that you're not alone. You will not be abandoned. You will not be left behind. The cameras at some point may leave. The media may get tired of the story, but we will not. We are on your side, and we will see this through. We're going to keep at this every day until the leak is stopped, until this coastline is clean and your communities are made whole again. That's my promise to you.
President Obama's promise on Friday in Louisiana. Okay, Jonathan, Robert Kuttner, here we are. You have both done big, overarching kind of analyses of the president's first year and a half, and there have been many crises in that time. Now he stands in the middle of one that at least so far nobody can get a grip on. We want to kind of look at both the big arch and the crisis he's in the middle of right now. Does this crisis, Jonathan, tell us something important about this president and where he's come to in this first year and a half?
Yeah, I think it does. In my book, The Promise, my aim is not just to tell you what I think about what he's done, but to give everybody more information on which to make their own judgments and tell people what happened that was not on NPR, that was not in the newspapers, the backstory of this presidency and what kind of a guy he's like, what kind of a leader he is. And what I found, Tom, is that he's a president who doesn't really believe in gestures.
Everybody, so he's not going to say, I'm your daddy.
Yeah, everybody assumed that he would ace communications and struggle in executive leadership. And what happened, and I think this was a great surprise to me at least, was that he struggled in communications and did not fully understand how to operate in the theater of the presidency. And yet behind the scenes in meetings and in, you know, making tough decisions, he was a very crisp and effective executive. I'm critical of him, as Bob is, on the banking bailouts, for instance, and in some other areas. But as a president, I think he's had a number of underappreciated successes. But giving voice to public outrage is not one of them. And he had a problem all year long in communicating the anger that so many Americans feel.
Maybe a problem, you know, brought to a superhead with this super spill in the Gulf. Bob Cuttner, I mean, your very book title is Presidency in Peril. What do you see this crisis, the oil crisis, telling us about Barack Obama?
Well, I agree with much of what Jonathan said. It is another teachable moment, like the financial collapse was, where the president has not quite risen to the occasion. And these teachable moments come. They're potentially transformative moments. Roosevelt's the great example. Lyndon Johnson in the civil rights crisis is another example, where history deals you a card you were not expected to be dealt. And instead of going along with the agenda that you hope to carry out, you take it as not just a crisis, but an opportunity to move public opinion. And that is part of what it takes to be a great president. And presidents who assume office in a crisis are typically great presidents or failed presidents. And a lot of us, I think, looking at the character of the man, looking at his life odyssey, looking at the crisis he was facing, felt that this could be a great president. And the irony is that he can be effective in private. He can be effective administratively. He cannot have the inner demons that drove so many of our presidents to self-defeating behavior, and still not rise to the occasion. And there were moments when it looked as if he had really embarked on a learning curve. After the Massachusetts election of Scott Brown, he discovered his inner partisan. But again, I think his inner conciliator often trumps his inner partisan. So he has the potential to be a great president. He is far from it yet.
Big picture, as I read your two books, Jonathan, I read you kind of saying, give this guy a break. He's done big, big stuff. In a short time, he inherited a big crisis. Jury's still out. Bob Cuttner, it's kind of a, if I may, kind of a mainstream view. Bob Cuttner with a kind of progressive agenda saying, we had big dreams, Bob, and this president may fall short. When you define failure, I guess you mean failure to step up and be a new FDR in a way.
Well, no, it's not just that I happen to be a progressive and I thought that he could carry out a progressive agenda. Even if he falls short of carrying out the kind of progressive agenda I'd like to see him carry out, if he doesn't get the financial system under control, mm-hmm. or it's serving the real economy, if he doesn't get unemployment down, if he doesn't do something about the mortgage crisis, and now if he doesn't do something about the oil spill, it isn't just that he falls short of his potential as a possible progressive president. It's that he falls on his face, and time is running out. If the Republicans take back one House of Congress or even pick up 35 seats in the House and 5 or 6 in the Senate, then you're into a Clintonian era of triangulation where the Republicans are able to veto anything he tries. At least he's had some victories in the first year and a half. And then he's basically stymied for the second 2 years of his first term, and he looks even more ineffective. He is even more ineffective. So it's not just that he falls short as a potentially great progressive president, it's that he falls short, period. And he's got a few months to pick up his game, to demonstrate to people that even though we're not out of the woods, that he's on their side. Unemployment was 18% in 1934, but the Democrats picked up seats 2 years into Roosevelt's first term because even though the crisis wasn't over, there was no doubt that he was on their side.
Jonathan Alter, you say, look, this guy has had big accomplishments. He's a president, has big accomplishments already. This hasn't been school uniforms, the stuff Bob's afraid he'll fall back on.
Well, actually, I have a scene in my book. I try to do as much fly-on-the-wall stuff as I can. And at one point when Rahm Emanuel, as he told me, said, "I begged the president not to do this," talking about health care.
Not to go first with the big health care push.
Not to go first. Mm-hmm. Remember, Franklin Roosevelt waited 2 years before he introduced his Social Security bill, which the original bill was very unpopular with liberals because it covered so few seniors at first.
And as Bob Kuttner points out, it was half a dozen years before he had his whole sort of what we now think of as the FDR agenda through.
That's correct. So Obama was moving very aggressively, and when they wanted him to scale back, he said, look, I wasn't sent here to do school uniforms. It was a not-so-veiled shot at Bill Clinton. So I think he did do big things. I think he's made much more progress on the economy than he's given credit for. He did, along with Ben Bernanke, prevent another Great Depression. Remember, we were losing 740,000 jobs a month when he took office in January of 2009. We're now adding about 230,000 jobs a month. Now, is unemployment much fiercer than anybody expected? Yes, but if we'd stayed on the pace that we were on when he took office, we would have been in another Great Depression by the end of 2009. So the stimulus, the much maligned $787 billion stimulus, it was poorly framed by the administration, poorly sold. It's not a cure-all, but it has had some effect in preventing layoffs and generating some economic activity, as have the big bailouts and the Fed policy. But it's true that he does not connect yet the way he needs to with the American people.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Obama presidency, a year and a half in the midst of oil spill crisis and much more. Jonathan Alter is with us. His new book is The Promise, President Obama, Year One. Robert Kuttner joins us from San Diego. His new book, both out here, is A Presidency in Peril, The Inside Story of Obama's Promise, Wall Street's Power and the Struggle to Control Our Economic Future. The spill is out there and a lot more, but he's talking about the spill. Big press conference, first in a long time. We'll talk about that last Thursday. Here he is, accepting responsibility.
My job is to get this fixed. And in case anybody wonders, in any of your reporting, in case you're wondering who's responsible, I take responsibility. It is my job to make sure that everything is done to shut this down.
It's my job, said the president, again and again last week, but he's taking some pretty sharp barbs now. Robert Kuttner, Maureen Dowd on Sunday calls him President Spock, as in Spock from Star Trek, you know, the kind of emotionless one. Okay, you know, she's a pro at that kind of cat claw, but that's out there now. And James Carville had kind of the same message. What about that? Do you see an out-of-touch president?
I'm less worried about his capacity to communicate on this one, although that's certainly part of the problem, than I am about how slow off the mark he was to undo some of the stuff Bush had done. I mean, it was not exactly a secret that the Interior Department was captive to the oil industry. I think one of the reasons not to have led on health care was that health care sucked out all the oxygen in the room, and they were so focused on health care that a lot of other equally important things didn't get done. They're so focused on the forms of running a whistle-clean operation that they are taking longer than any other administration has taken to send up nominations. And then, of course, nominations run into a Republican buzzsaw.
Yep.
So I think one substantive criticism, as opposed to a criticism which I share with Jonathan on his communication style, is he could have cleaned house earlier. He could have led. He could have gotten on top of this. And now, of course, to say, I take responsibility. It's my job to fix this. What does that mean? It's a little bit hollow in the sense that the person on the Gulf Coast or the person watching it on television scratches his head and says, well, yeah, it's his job to fix it, but he ain't fixing it. So it almost plays to weakness. I do want to come back quickly, if there's time, to one thing Jonathan said about the stimulus package. It's true that $787 billion is a lot of money. On the other hand, it's offset by a drag of about $600 billion in state and local cuts. And so the net stimulus is very small. And by talking up the need for deficit reduction before we're in a robust recovery, he makes it easier for conservative Democrats and for Republicans to say, well, I'm not voting aid to this and I'm not voting aid to that because it's not paid for, and cutting the deficit is more important. So again, it puts him at odds with what the public needs to hear and what the public needs to see.
And we've still got economic crisis aplenty in Europe and right here. I want to come to the economy, but on this issue of how the president was positioned when the well blew a mile down. I mean, I wonder, Jonathan, from your reporting, you know, people may say, well, this is on the left may say, this is another price of his effort at centrism. You know, he didn't come in wholesale, swinging the axe, cleaning out the closet, the minerals and mine management, MMS, whatever that is. You know, just another place that should have been cleaned out right away. And tiptoeing in a little bit may not have been the way to get his hands around this. He said, well, it wasn't my fault, but yet he's had a year and a half now in his lap.
Well, you know, bureaucracies change very slowly. I agree with Bob that I think he could have moved more quickly and that there was a policy of no distractions when it came to health care. But I still think, and maybe Bob and I disagree on this, that he was right to move ahead with health care. When I interviewed him on the subject at the end of last year, and, you know, I reviewed the fact that his vice president, his chief of staff, his top domestic advisor, David Axelrod,
also, don't go there first.
They all said, don't do this. It's too much freight on, mm-hmm. on the truck. And he said, well, you know, I told Nancy Pelosi that I'd probably go down 10 to 15 points if I did this, and then I might not get reelected. And so I said, okay, Mr. President, so why did you do it? And he said, because if we didn't do it now, it wouldn't get done. So, you know, if he had decided to put it off, we would not have what is the most significant piece of social legislation since Medicare and Medicaid in 1965. That's a long time ago. And he is now, whatever one's criticism of him, in league with Roosevelt and Johnson as a president of domestic accomplishment, somebody who has already accomplished much more and become a figure of history for reasons beyond the color of his skin. And so this, I think that what happened was the debate got so sidetracked on some of the specifics. And I say this as a strong supporter of the public option, but it got so focused on that we forgot what was accomplished here. We will look back and say, Can you believe that we lived in a country where people had to sell their house if their kid got cancer?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that we put up with that for so many decades. So that's now soon to be part of the American past, that era of cruelty, really, when it came to health care. And so he felt like it maybe was worth it to put off some of these other things that could be very controversial in order to get this done early.
You're giving him credit for that. You're putting his name up on that stone with FDR and Johnson.
I'm not saying he's as great a president as but this is
some accomplishments on the board. But let me ask you, because you write about the president's philosophy of persistence.
Right.
But Bob Kuttner's saying if he doesn't get his act together in a handful of months here, right now, this could be a failed presidency.
Here's the thing. We are always
I'd like to come back on that.
You will,
the
Bob.
Punditocracy, but I just want to respond to this point that you made, Bob. You know, we're always asked in the pundit class, like, what's going to happen? You know, is he going to fail? Look, there are 100 ways for any president to fail, but there are also 100 ways for him to reinvent himself. And what I'm interested in and what I try to do in my book is to tell you what happened, not make probably wrong predictions about what will happen. We can't predict the stock market. We can't predict anybody's political health with any degree of accuracy. But what we can do is try to write a blend of journalism and history that gives you some basis on which to understand somebody better and how they make decisions.
Bob Kuttner, you've got him right there in peril, that kind of teetering on failure.
Well, I have a different view of the health effort. First of all, you don't have to do everything in the first 2 years. Social Security is an example. And the problem was that his failure to get a stronger recovery. Yes, we don't have a Great Depression, but we do have a great stagnation. We are at risk of having a lost generation of young people. I think if he had focused more on the economy. And I'm not saying this is Monday morning quarterbacking. I mean, I wrote it in Obama's Challenge in 2008. I wrote it in my columns. If he had focused more on the economy, he would have built more political capital, more credibility, and he would have come into the second half of his first term with the stature and the public support to get a stronger health bill through. I think by doing it the way he did it, it's not in a league with FDR or LBJ. He is doing it through the private insurance industry without sufficient regulation of the private insurance industry. And Social Security and Medicare are public programs. They rebuilt faith in the public sector. This reinforces the power of the private insurance industry. And even by 2019, only about two-thirds of the uninsured are going to be insured. And it also has unpopular elements like the mandate, like the diversion of Medicare funds, which were the political price that he had to pay for doing it as a partner of a not very well-loved insurance industry. So I think, sure, winning beats losing. But there was a lot of collateral damage along the way in doing health insurance the way he did. And I agree with – that's probably the only thing I agree with Rahm Emanuel about. But I think this was a political miscalculation. And, yes, he snatched victory out of the jaws of defeat, but it was a very blemished victory that didn't enhance his stature in the way his stature might have been enhanced by a more robust recovery.
I want to ask about this President Spock characterization, whether that sticks. This is a man who brought people to tears earlier, something Spock seldom did. We've got a lot of callers here, though. Nashville, Tennessee. Charles, you're on the air.
As a liberal, as a strong liberal African-American, I'm totally disappointed in Barack Obama and his entire family. I think Barack Obama has spent too much time trying to straddle the fence or walk down the middle of the road. Barack, you know, the center of the road is like a parallel line that goes on to infinity. And if you don't, even the chicken has sense enough to cross to one side or the other sooner or later. Barack Obama advisors to me seem to be running the country. As a liberal, I'm totally disappointed in his health care, in his war, in his failure to close Guantanamo. But for as fair-minded Americans, Barack Obama should be in high standing because he saved the economy. He did pass health care. So only liberals, and then liberals are often misrepresented. I'm not concerned about the oil spill. I'm concerned that Barack Obama didn't come out forcefully against offshore oil drilling. That's the fault I hold against him. He cannot be held responsible for the drill, for the accident. Even BP is getting too much blame. The shuttle go up and crash, but we don't stop the shuttle. This was an accident that if you drill offshore, you have to take this risk. Thank you.
Charles, you're good, and I appreciate your call. Bob Kuttner, I mean, Charles seems to be, in a way, lined up. Your book, in a sense, wants a path change from Obama. And if you don't get a change of path for the country, it's a failure. And Charles seems to line up with you on that.
Well, again, it's more than just wanting a path change. I mean, I could have written a book saying, gee, I wish Bill Clinton were more of a liberal. But the stakes are so much higher now because he either succeeds big or he fails big politically, since unemployment is going to stay high for some time to come without a change in policy. And the housing crisis is going to drag down people's hopes and people's economic situation. There was a story in the Times yesterday about Memphis's black middle class just going down the drain because we're not doing anything to resolve the mortgage crisis. And yeah, he didn't have to embrace drilling. I mean, this is the most catastrophic environmental disaster ever at this point. And this could be a teachable moment to say to the American public, one, the oil companies have too damn much power. And two, if you ever needed palpable evidence of why we need to be on a wholly different energy path, this is it. But I don't know whether you attribute this to communications or temperament or his behind-the-scenes style rather than his out-front style. Whatever it is, he's not rising to the occasion yet. And I think a presidency in peril speaks to the frustrations that a lot of progressives feel, not just about his failure thus far to advance a progressive agenda, but the risk that his presidency will crash and burn across the board because he doesn't have enough of the people with him yet.
Jonathan, I want to get you on that. Let me get one more call here first. Sarah in Boston. Sarah, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Mr. Alter, it's a pleasure to speak with you. I've been a fan for years. You did a piece a few years ago about sort of fantasizing how things might have gone if George W. had taken a different tack after September 11th, which was brilliant. And
Thank you, sir.
For giving me the opportunity. My comment today is I sort of liken the reaction and the criticism to President Obama, of whom I'm also a huge fan and supporter, to the response during the campaign. And, you know, people would get sort of hysterical about how he was screwing up, and I would get despondent about how, oh, shoot, he's given the wrong message again. And in each and every instance, he turned out to be smarter and better than the rest of us. And so I continue to have faith that I know time is short, but that he has a handle on this, and if he doesn't, he'll get one by surrounding himself with the right people. And I'll take your response off the air. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Sarah. So there's Charles in Nashville, not happy liberal. Sarah, well, she's got faith in the guy. He's called it well over time by her lights.
You know, I have to say, after spending a lot of time talking to more than 200 people who see him, either every day or on a regular basis, I'm a little more in Sarah's camp, and particularly on the question of who's really running the show. Charles suggested that his aides were running things, and I learned to the contrary that this is a president who's very much in charge. And his aides, you know, I have all the kind of juicy details about the squabbling of his aides, but the real point is that he is a crisp and decisive leader. I do think he's made a mistake, as Bob pointed out, in this oil spill, in not coming out and forthrightly saying in a very clear way that BP will pay for all of this.
I've heard him say that, but he says it pointedly enough.
And he said at the end of his press conference, he said that we need to use this as a moment to have a new comprehensive energy policy. So he says the right things, but he's a little too allergic to sound bites. He thinks that sound bites and talking points are, he almost considers them to be insults. But, you know, if you think back to, say, Lincoln's house divided against itself cannot stand, or FDR's the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Those were sound bites. They imprinted themselves on the minds of the American people. And he needs to deal with the media culture the way it is, not just the way he wants it
to be.
Why
hasn't he had a full-scale press conference for 10 months before last Thursday?
I think this is a huge mistake that he made, because not only is it important to have those press conferences, and by the way, he's held three times as many one-on-one interviews as President Bush did in his first year, more than 150. So it's not like he's inaccessible, but the most important thing about a press conference is actually something that nobody sees, and that is that the preparation for a press conference requires you to go with your aides through what they call a murder board, where they're asking you the toughest questions that they can think of in preparation. And that gives you more of a sense of what's actually going on in your own government.
You've got to find the message that responds.
And you also have to be up on everything, which he mostly is, but he's so confident that he's up on everything that he hates this exercise of debate prep or press conference prep, and that gets him off key too often. But I think Sarah's right that he does have the capacity to recover.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Obama presidency, a year and a half in the midst of oil spill crisis and much more. Robert Kuttner is with us. A Presidency in Peril is his new book. Jonathan Alter's is The Promise. Excerpts from both at our website, onpointradio.org. Here he was on March 23rd, when, after everybody thought it had been down and out, the president got his health care reform. Whether you're for it or against it, he succeeded in getting it. Here were his remarks as he prepared to sign that historic legislation.
Our presence here today is remarkable and improbable. With all the punditry, all of the lobbying, all of the game playing that passes for governing in Washington, It's been easy at times to doubt our ability to do such a big thing, such a complicated thing, to wonder if there are limits to what we as a people can still achieve.
But this is a country, he said, that doesn't scale back on his aspirations message, neither would he. Yet it's tough out there. At that press conference last Thursday, the president was pressed hard here by veteran news service reporter Helen Thomas on another front. She went after him on Afghanistan.
When are you going to get out of Afghanistan? Why are you continuing to kill and die there? What is the real excuse? And don't give us this Bushism. If we don't go there, they'll all come here.
So there's the president facing Helen Thomas, as generations of presidents have before him. Jonathan Alter and Robert Kuttner are here. Let's go to Toby in Columbia, South Carolina. Toby, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm a bit long fan, 20-year fan. I've got to say I'm a bit disappointed you're not treating this biggest world catastrophe in the world of human civilization. Past couple of weeks, you've had innocuous programs such as this one today and the one that's going to follow. The two relief wells are both over a mile deep. I believe that your shows the rest of the week and maybe the summer should be call-ins from scientists. I think they should send two small explosives to the bottom of those relief wells, just small bombs, and implode the whole thing today. Thank you.
Toby, thanks for your call. Now, I mean, we've had a parade of scientists on here, and we will have more, and couldn't agree more that it's the big, big story. Leadership matters in the middle of a story like that, though, and here we come right back to it, this sort of sense of helplessness at the scale of what's going on, Jonathan, and the president standing there. David Brooks writes today that this is the test Americans face. You know, do you want small government? Do you want a government that can do this kind of thing? Can any government do this kind of thing? And meanwhile, people say, we just want this solved. He's the commander-in-chief.
Well, you know, I think you have to draw a distinction between capping the well and dealing with the cleanup. He's not Aquaman, as has been pointed out. And to say the relief wells, just to drill through all of that rock, as I understand it, is, no matter what they do, a 2 to 3 month proposition.
So we're looking at August, and given what we've seen so far, who knows even then?
Right. And so this is a huge untested science experiment, I don't think you can blame the president if that doesn't go well. I mean, that's expecting too much of him. But what you can say is that he needs to be the commander-in-chief of the cleanup. And I also think it's an opportunity for job creation, not just for shrimpers and fishermen in that area, but for other Americans who are looking for work. This will
hard
be
to look at the cleanup, though, when it's still gurgling and gurgling and gushing.
But it will be. But we should be prepared. And what's happened is, and Bob and I agree on this, I think they made a bad decision in not doing direct hiring the way Franklin Roosevelt did with the government and the WPA. They have relied on the private sector to do the hiring, and sometimes the government just needs to put people to work directly. This is an opportunity. If they're trained over, I think, only a 2 or 3 day period and given the proper protective equipment, when the hurricane or whatever brings a lot of this ashore, and there is likely to be these little tar balls all over
hurricane
that region.
Season starts today.
And then and at that point, we need, as a country, to be prepared to have an army of cleanup workers. And this can provide some short-term employment for thousands of Americans. But I don't get the sense that they're thinking this way. And it's something that I write about in my book that, you know, for all of their victories and all the good things that they've done, they're a little bit less creative when it comes to the policy side than they need to be. They're not thinking outside the box. Obama has a bit of a weakness for experts who sometimes reject unusual creative policy thinking.
Bob Kuttner, in your perfect world, what would the response have been, and maybe even the prelude have been, to the blowout in the Gulf?
Well, you know, there are two big things government does in this kind of a crisis. One is to do the kind of thing Jonathan is talking about in the cleanup. But the other big thing government does is to regulate. And the similarity of the banking crisis and the oil crisis is that in both cases, industry invented doomsday machines that if they broke, there was no easy fix. There was no easy fix to the financial catastrophe that Wall Street innovators invented, absent regulatory strictures. And there's no easy fix to this. So you need much, much tougher regulation of these guys going in, and then you need a more robust fix coming out, and you need a president who leads on both fronts. In the banking situation, because of the way they propped up the banks, Wall Street recovered much more quickly than the real economy recovered. One thing we haven't talked about is how the initiative is passed to the Tea Parties. And if Obama is not careful in the oil crisis, the initiative is going to pass not to critics like me who want him to succeed, but to critics on the far right who want him to fail, who before this is over are going to make this his failure rather than the failure of deregulation and BP and George W. Bush, which is where the failure properly ought to be laid. But the problem is, if you inherit a crisis and you're the chief executive, the people expect you to deal with it robustly, with alacrity, with creativity. And Jonathan and I agree on that, too. He is a bit of a manager-in-chief rather than a president and commander-in-chief, and he's got to be both.
And he's been, you know, he's been in charge of the shovel brigade, cleaning up after the elephants instead of initiating as he wants to do.
Sitting on the elephant.
And, you know, the cleaning up the mess left by the elephants as they leave the circus. But I think that it's important to understand that he can reinvent himself and that he does go through a very thorough and impressive process behind closed doors. You mentioned Afghanistan. Now, whatever one thinks of the policy, and I have my doubts about whether it will work, I was very impressed as I reported what happened behind the closed doors of the Situation Room, behind the closed doors of the Oval Office, as he pushed back hard against
the Pentagon
mm-hmm. when they tried to box him in and manipulate him. And he has made it clear that we are going to begin to come out in 2011. Now, people go, yeah, yeah, sure, sure.
Mm-hmm.
If in the chapters that I have, one of them is called Chaosistan. It's pretty clear.
Which is what they were warning against.
Yeah, it's pretty clear that this president is bound and determined not to have an open-ended, long-term commitment the way the Pentagon wanted.
But Bob, are you confident the president can reinvent himself, that is, come out afresh, anew, different from what we've seen in the first nearly year and a half in office now?
Yeah, I think he could. I think he has the intellect. I think he has the capacity as a learner. His biggest enemy at this point is the clock. If he doesn't do more for the average person so that he takes the narrative back from the Tea Party right, then the Republicans pick up huge number of seats. And then if you think they're obstructing now, wait until you see what they do if they pick up one house or if they have an effective working majority in league with conservative Democrats in the House of Representatives.
But what does reinvention mean? I mean, if President Obama is kind of the peak of cool, calm, and collected. I mean, does reinvention mean he's got to knock over some furniture in the Oval Office or in the national
policy? Here's what's heartbreaking to people like me. We've seen flashes of passion. We've seen flashes of real leadership. We've seen him get angry at banks, and that wasn't just theatrical. We saw him in the ninth inning with two outs give himself permission to be a partisan in the health fight. Give himself permission to do it with 51 votes, even though that went against all of his impulses. And the question is whether that learning curve can get steeper. We know that he has the stuff, but he hasn't been deploying the right stuff in large enough quantities yet.
Yeah. I guess I just don't agree with that, Bob. I mean, I think, he made a series of decisions that not all progressives would agree with, but they turned out pretty well. For instance, not nationalizing the banks. He made the same decision FDR did when he was pressured by New Dealers to nationalize the banks. Most of that bailout money has been paid back. The auto bailout went much better than expected when they assessed PolitiFact, Pulitzer Prize-winning organization, assessed all of his campaign promises. They found that he had kept close to 400 out of 500 of his campaign promises. So while we were busy with our own lives, he was putting a lot of points on the board and getting a lot of good things done, and I'm less interested in him satisfying, you know, some desire to throw a punch or deck somebody, which it's gratifying.
What James Carville's shouting for last week.
Part of me would like to see him do that more. He did do it to the insurance companies, but I'd like to see him do it more. But I don't think that's at the core of his presidency. For him, it's about getting things done. And he is on a path, despite some failures, with closing Guantanamo Bay and some of the rest. But he has gotten a lot done. And what I was interested in doing in The Promise was to just explain the way he works and the way what his friend Marty Nesbitt calls the Rubik's Cube in his brain works. He is trying to think a few steps ahead. I don't think he's on the cusp of blowing his entire presidency. I think even if the Republicans make some gains, which I don't think will be as significant as predicted this fall, he'll still figure out other ways to be a president of significant achievement.
Bob, do you think he can get coolly to success, this president, President Obama?
Well, I think he's got to learn from his mistakes more effectively than he's done in the past. I think one big one is to be putting deficit reduction ahead of job creation way too early in the game. I think, Jonathan, with respect, nationalize the banks as a straw man that was created by Larry Summers. No one was saying nationalize the banks in the sense of taking them over permanently. A lot of people like Joe Stiglitz and Paul Krugman and myself were saying, if you have a bank that is insolvent in everything but name, it's better policy to resolve it, to shut it down, to see who takes the hit, how much of a hit is taken by taxpayers or by bondholders or by shareholders, and reorganize it. That's not nationalizing the banks
It turned out that wasn't necessary.
And yes,
it wasn't. Because through the stress tests and some other things, by the way, you and I agree that he should have used his leverage over the banks when he had it at the beginning of 2009. And I hit him pretty hard on that in the book. He could have dictated terms to the banks in the way that the IMF does internationally. So we're basically in agreement. But on this question of taking over a couple of banks, it turned out not to be necessary. And I wish people could agree. In a retrospect, it would have probably caused runs on those banks. And I think the estimates of another $1 trillion are pretty accurate. So sometimes history renders a verdict that even a Nobelist like Joe Stiglitz should fess up to the fact that to be wrong.
What do you say, Bob?
Here's why that's mistaken. I think by propping up the banks, they got themselves into a position where over a 2 or 3 year period, the whole policy is rebuilding bank balance sheets rather than encouraging banks to put credit out to small businesses and homeowners, so that the exercise becomes how do we shore up the banks rather than we shore up the economy. So, yeah, the money got paid back, but the real economy paid a huge price. And politically, the result of that is that the Tea Parties can say with some justice that he's putting the interests of Wall Street over the interests of Main Street. So there was a road not taken that I think was a better road. We can just disagree on that.
Let me get a couple more callers here. Sandy, Newport, Rhode Island. Sandy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking the call. Yeah. I think that the president should, or any president, should just get up on a podium and say, you know, we're mad as hell and we're not taking this anymore. This banking crisis and the oil crisis has brought us to our knees, and the oil crisis isn't even half over yet. And no one seems to get that message. In the trenches, people are suffering every way they turn around. It just doesn't seem like there's enough being the president isn't mad enough.
But this isn't a president who's likely to throw his window open and yell that out into the backyard of the White House. But we got it, Sandy. Alabama, Auburn, Alabama. Alan, you're on.
Hey, yeah, thanks for taking the call. My only thing is with the conservatives and how they're holding Obama accountable for this is, you know, conservatives want a smaller government, but yet when something like this happens, they want him to just come in and fix it all.
Right. It's a great
Big Daddy.
Point. It's a great point. Total hypocrisy.
So there we go. That criticism is going to remain there. But the question behind it, big or small or in between, and who stops the oil?
You know, and
Sandy, who wants him to get angry, pound the podium.
The factionalists, as I call them, I don't think they're real populists, these Tea Party folks. They are not particularly mad at Wall Street. They're blaming everything on government. And then when there's a crisis, they suddenly want the government. Or the version of it during the healthcare debate was, you know, the down with big government and keep your hands off my Medicare, you know, which is that,
right,
the Tea Party
right.
people were shouting that, which is about the most hypocritical thing one can imagine. Yeah. So I think the caller makes a great point that they're in the grip of this logical contradiction. And I also think that they've been hyped. They still add, if you take Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of them, all the Tea Party people, which is basically just old wine and new bottles, it's the same old reactionaries we've always had in this country, and they add up to about 20%. They haven't gone higher than that. And when they have 10,000 people at one of their demonstrations, it gets a lot of press. When pro-immigration demonstrators turn out a million strong, it's barely covered. So I think part of this is about media coverage. But one thing I want to make clear that where Bob and I really strongly agree is that, as you know, FDR, when FDR died and the funeral procession moved up Pennsylvania Avenue and a grieving man fell to his knees and another man helped him to his feet and said, "Did you know the president?" And the grieving man said, "No, but he knew me." And Barack Obama is not yet at a point where the American people really feel like he knows them and their problems. And that's where he needs to get to.
There we are, nearly a year and a half in with the oil gushing. Jonathan Alter, author of The Promise, President Obama Year One, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Tom.
And Robert Kuttner, author of A Presidency in Peril, The Inside Story of Obama's Promise, Wall Street's Power, The Struggle to Control Our Economic Future. Thank you, Bob. This is On Point.